continence management. We're going to go over the prompted voiding protocol. We're going to try and leave time for questions and answers, and then we'll talk about the next assignment. I'm on the next slide. Please mute your phones if you guys can. I'm on the fourth slide. Before we start, I just want to mention the online discussion group. This is an exchange group for us. It includes more than 100 members, all the nursing homes, and at most nursing homes, a number of staff members. If you reply to a CAPTA message, a CAPTA discussion group message, it's automatically going to go to all members of the group, and that's by intention. If you want to send a message directly to me, you have a question about whether or not I received your pre-training quiz, for example, you are going to have to enter my email address specifically. You're going to have to take out the CAPTA address before you hit send, and then put in my address. If you've got a clinical question or a question related to one of the homework assignments, I think that's perfectly a valid one to send to all the group, because my feeling is if you've got a question, probably somebody else has a question. Not everyone, but maybe others, and we could all, and so an answer to that question might benefit more than you. So feel free to use it as a discussion group. Here we go. Could we mute phone star 6? Star 6, yeah. Can I mute you?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Let me just mute everybody else. Sorry. Otherwise, we will not be able to hear the speaker. So a little patience with the discussion group. It's a new tool for a lot of us. I know I have hit that CAPTA return address by mistake a few times myself, and then everybody sees something that I meant maybe just for one person. But I think the more practice we have with it, the better we're all going to get. And again, I don't want to discourage people from using it, because it is a valuable tool for learning more, for asking questions, for sharing experiences, and so I hope we can use it that way. With that, I want to get on to the main program, and again, with Dr. Schnelli, I'm on now the fifth slide here, Jeff. We're now at your presentation, Jeff.
All right, so should I tell you what I'm switching, or can you tell?
No, I can't tell. So I have you right now at MDS 3.0, bladder and bowel is our slide. We're going to take a look at this MDS item.
And the first slide is MDS 3.0,
yep.
Bladder and bowel, H1 urinary incontinence.
Yes.
So the focus of today's presentation is to try to give you the rationale for why you should do a 2 or 3 day trial of toileting assistance, the toilet people, to identify people that are appropriate for toileting programs, bowel and bladder programs. And to do that, to make that justification, it's well, I think, to start with a new MDS 3.0, which contains some new explicit language about this. The slide that you see, MDS 3.0, bowel and bladder H1, is not particularly new. I would like to go from that one to the next one, which means MDS 3.0 H2 urinary toileting program. This is relevant to today's conversation, and it is new on the MDS 3.0. So now the MDS will be asking you whether or not you had a trial of the toileting program, scheduled toileting, prompted bleeding, or bladder training, whether that's been attempted or not, for a patient. And it asks you, like, no, yes, able to determine. And it also asks you to specifically rate the resident's response to that toileting program. No improvement, decreased wetness, completely dry, unable to determine. The next slide then asks you the question, is a toileting program, scheduled toileting, prompted voiding, or bladder training currently being used to manage the resident's urinary incontinence? point is, there's a whole lot more emphasis on conducting a clothing trial and documenting whether or not somebody is either on a trial or whether they're on a clothing program. I think at this point, it's best to say something about what the difference between scheduled clothing, prompted voting, and ladder training may be, since the MDF captured all three of these in the same sentence, basically. I'm actually going to talk a lot more about prompted voiding in a few minutes. But prompted voiding is basically a scheduled toileting program with a communication protocol. In both programs, scheduled toileting and prompted voiding, you really go to the resident on some regular schedule, in most cases every 2 hours. And in prompted voiding, you offer them toileting assistance and try to get them to say whether we're trying to go to the bathroom or not. Scheduled toileting doesn't have that component. It doesn't have any communication component. Particularly, it pretty much is just designed to get there every couple hours and change somebody if they need it and then toilet. What's the difference? Well, I think there's two differences. One is, you know, prompted voiding, you just see it looks better because ideally you would like your aides talking to the patient about what's going to happen. I mean, do you need touch-worthy assistance? Let me take you, so on. It's better to do that and not talk about it. But number two, from a survey perspective, there's a lot of emphasis on individualization these days. And prompted voiding is basically a very strong form of individualization because in prompted voiding, at each contact, you're asking the resident whether they'll try to use the bathroom or not and acting on their preference. I mean, if you just can't get to say they will, they say, no, I don't go, I don't want to go, or whatever. And that's in the preference of individualization, even if they get wet as a result of it, it's still individualization. If you can say they'll go, that's fine, and that's individualization. Our experience is this. Most patients, 90%+, can be brought to say yes or no to prompt for toileting assistance. There's only a small number, 5 or 10% maybe, you can't get them verbalized and who might benefit just from scheduled toileting and not even talking about it. But it's a very small percentage. So it's a good idea to teach aides to do the communication part. It's a good idea for survey compliance, and it's a good idea just from dealing with the issue, I think. At any rate, the point is, the MDF is making an increased emphasis on this. There's talk about having quality indicators developed about how many patients do have a trial of toileting assistance, and who the patients who have, how many were elected, or identified as being suitable, and so on and so forth. Whether that will happen or not, I don't know. But there will definitely be increased survey surveillance on this MDF item of whether a trial of toileting assistance was done. I just switched to the next slide, which is not unusual either. It just asks for the usual rating of urinary incontinence, whether they're always incontinent or not, etc. We can go past that. And so the next slide on bowel incontinence, which again, I don't think is that unusual. It just asks you for a rating of how often somebody is bowel incontinent. Actually, in a future lecture, I will be talking specifically about fecal or bowel incontinence and constipation as it relates to prompted voiding. Won't do it today. But nonetheless, MDF 3.0 will continue to ask you to rate bowel incontinence. And then the next slide, I think it's also a revision or something new, because it does ask you explicitly whether a toileting program is currently being used to manage a resident's bowel incontinence. No, yes. And whether bowel patterns, whether constipation is present. This is an elevation of importance of these issues, I think, for bowel incontinence in the nursing home. What two things really asking you to do? Well, a lot of patients have catheters, but not a lot. Many patients with urinary catheters still need toileting programs for bowel incontinence. They want to make sure they're getting them. The other issue here is that the great majority of patients in nursing homes really are dually incontinent. They have both bowel and bladder incontinent. And basically, you need a toileting program to cover both of those issues. And these MDS 3.0 items are targeting that. So my point is, you know, one of the reasons that we're giving today's presentation on how to do a toileting trial is because there's going to be increased regulatory importance attached to it, as witness value three quarter cup squash. I'm going to go to the next slide now, but that's not the only reason to do it. The next slide reads why target residents for a tourism program. And there's really two reasons that I alluded to last time. Number one, despite popular belief among some people, not everybody in a nursing home is suitable for a scheduled toilet or prompted bleeding or bladder retraining program. And in fact, we've done it hundreds of times now, and 30 to 60% of patients, depending on the home time you do it, 30 to 60% of patients are just not responsive to a toileting assistance program. But they've got to be identified and separated out. I mean, if you put those people on a toileting assistance program, AIDS won't be able to do it. They won't make everyone want to. I mean, it's just, if the procurement requires reason because it looks better, that's the way on a toileting program. Who can't respond? You've got to separate them out because it takes a lot of time and focus your attention on people who can be responsive. The other dimension is that not everybody wants to toilet. I'll just give you an example of that. In a recent trial, clinical trial that we just did, we had our staff going around to people every 2 hours offering toileting assistance. This was a bowel and bladder training program directed towards fecal incontinence. But after about 4 weeks, about 8% of the people withdrew consent to participation as it bothered them too much. They didn't want us coming every 2 hours and checking and changing and offering, assistance. And that's not unusual. That's 10% of the people that we do this with have had that reaction consistently. So the reality is, not everybody wants toileting assistance back regularly in a nursing home, and not everybody can benefit, and you've got to be able to separate out those who want it and can benefit from those who can't. I'm now moving on to the next slide. The next slide reads one of the marginal predictors of responsiveness. And the marginal predictors, predictors are not that good, are mental status, measures of bladder functioning, and ADL dependency measures. We actually had done a trial like that 20 years ago, where we did comprehensive mental status and urodynamic measures on a bunch of patients, and then did prompted bleeding types of trials and asked the question, who's responsive and who's not? Well, what happened here is that cognitive status measures like the MMSE, DPS, cognitive performance scale, were not highly predictive of how responsive somebody was to prompted bleeding and scheduled toileting. In fact, if anything, it's in the opposite direction. We're going to report very soon that people with lower cognitive status scores, as measured by the mini-mental status, if you know what that one is, highly correlated to CPS. Anyway, people with lower cognitive status scores actually did better on prompt avoiding and scheduled toileting programs than people with higher mental status. It's probably because people with higher mental status, if they're incontinent, are probably not incontinent so much because of physical dependency and dementia, which can be corrected with cognitive avoidance or scheduled toileting, but they're probably more likely incontinent because of psychological reasons, depression, or bladder issues that don't lend themselves to treatment with scheduled toileting or cognitive avoidance. The bladder measures themselves, which I'll talk about a little bit later, are not particularly predictive either. I mean, we did urodynamic measures on a number of patients to try to determine what their bladder capacity was, whether they had strep incontinence, which means they leaked when they coughed, urge incontinence, which means after they felt the sensation that they had the void, they had very little time before they had to act on that to get to the toilet, before they bladder emptied. And even though we found that about 25% of the people in the nursing home have strep incontinence, and about 37% have some form of urge incontinence, and a lot of people have a combination of both stress and urge, that these measures were not predictive of how they did our toilet program. They were only protected if it were really severe strep and common transmits. The upshot of this is that you can't select people, not that you would do it, because it's too hard to do them. You shouldn't and can't select people for a trauma rehabilitation program. I call it avoid the standard flu. Based on diagnosis of dementia, or based on some subjective impression that they're cognitively impaired, or even based on an objective measure of cognitive impairment, unless your objective measure of cognitive impairment presents a totally unresponsive to verbal requests. Other than that group, you know, totally unresponsive to verbal requests, there is an excellent chance that they will be able to respond to a prompt avoiding program, even if they have very low cognitive function otherwise. Similarly, ADL dependency, how dependent somebody was not predictive of how well, how responsive we were to a coding program. When we look at charts, so when we go around to the nation's nursing homes and we look what people document, a very common form of documentation is that somebody is placed on a check and change program because of dementia, because of cognitive impairment. That is not a good reason. And surveyors are being taught that that's not a good reason, so that eventually will get somebody in trouble. And if you're going to try to eliminate somebody from a cost-avoiding trial, a self-reporting trial based on cognitive impairment criteria, you better make it explicit. But you're eliminating them not just because of dementia, but you're eliminating them because they have such cognitive impairment that they're totally unresponsive to verbal requests. I'll move on to the next slide. So what are the best predictors? Like I'm saying, mental status, ADL dependency, neurodynamic bladder variables are not good predictors. What are good predictors, which is what we're going to teach you today, is a statistic called the appropriate coding ratio, which you can calculate after a 3-day cognitive avoiding trial, 3 hours a day, and rather than preferences, I mean, if a resident is explicitly telling you right from the very beginning, something like I've been in cognitive for a long time, I don't care about it anymore, you know, I don't want to bother with it, then that's an excellent predictor. You shouldn't bother with it, and some will tell you that. But they won't tell you that. Then the next best thing to do, or the best thing to do, is a 3-day cognitive avoiding trial, 8 hours a day, to calculate the cognitive avoiding ratio. So I'm going to the next slide. I think Amy has passed out to you cards for completing a 3-day cognitive avoiding trial, telling you what to do and what kind of data to record. This basically gives you the instructions for this 3 days. The instructions are your contact the resident every 2 hours. You focus the resident's attention on the breathing. I ask them whether they're wet or dry. You're supposed to check them for wetness and give them feedback about whether they're active or not. For some reason, they're highly absorbent diapers. People really can't tell whether they're wet or dry. You're trying to recreate that ability to tell whether they're wet or dry. And then you ask them if they'd like to use the toilet. And if they say yes, you assist them and record the results of the toileting record on the flip side, which I'll show you in a minute, and you give some positive reinforcement. So if they say no, you're basically saying, you know, at this point, and we'd like to try to use the toilet a urinal, and they say no. Well, if they haven't attempted to void for 4 hours, you should repeat the request once or twice before leaving. You know, usually with a statement like, well, it's been a while, are you sure you can hold it? I'm here, I can help you if you want to try. But, you know, if you keep pressing it, if it's been at least 4 hours, because the likelihood that there might be an accident if they don't go, is increasing as time goes by. Then you change what you went to let go, and then you tell the resident you'll be back in 2 hours. But the next shot of this, if you're asking a resident whether or not they're fact ill or not, and you assist them, and you take no for an answer, if they give you an answer, no, then that's an important statistic. Now, my next slide reads the post-coding ratio. Is that right?
No, there
okay.
is the...
Well, the trial results is what it should be. Right.
Yes, yes, it should be the trial results. And that's because the website is missing this slide.
All right, so let's go to the formal trial results. I presume that most people like me are on the website. I don't know if that's true. But I'm on the step here. I'm totally trial results. So basically, you have a card which takes you through the instructions that I just went through.
And
the resin that's going to try to go and you're checking it for wrecks. And what you're recording over 3 days, each day, you're recording their response. Are they wet? Are they dry? Did they tell me how to go? Did they not try to go? Whatever. And then you summarize that. You summarize it in A, column A, by counting the total number of times the resident used the toilet successfully.
Wait, hold up, Jack. You're now on a different, slide. Are you on toileting trial results?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. I was not there with them. Okay. Go ahead, sorry.
That was the... Okay, I'm on toilet trial results, yeah. And I'm going to go back in a minute to the appropriate toilet ratio. I think it's a little on the website, perhaps.
Okay.
Total number of times the resident used the toilet successfully. Number two is the pocket card. And so in 3 days, you pretty much just count the number of times they said yes and went. And on B, you're counting the total number of times that the resident was found wet or soiled. That's number one on your pocket card, according to that slide. And then you calculate an appropriate toileting ratio by taking A, the number of successful toilets, and dividing by A, the number of successful toilets, plus B, the number of times felt found wet or soiled. And then you're converting that to a percentage. So look at the next slide. So if you look at the next slide, my next slide reads total contents.
Yes, this is an example.
So if you're there, if you're at the slide that says total contents, this is that ratio. Let's say a 3 day period, when you get this, now a resident said yes 4 times, and successfully used the toilet 4 times for urination or bowel. And let's say they were never wet in those 3 days. So the appropriate toilet ratio would be 4 voids in the toilet divided by 4 voids in the toilet plus 0 voids on the clothes. 4 divided by 4 equals 100%. 100% means total contact. They were never wet. The next slide shows a suggested ratio to maintain somebody on a toileting program. Now, if you were just going to select somebody for a toileting rehabilitation program based explicitly on their performance during this 3 day trial, it would be much too severe to only put people on this trial who are 100% confident, because they're only doing this for 3 days. But what we found that if somebody 2/3 of the time basically has a 56% appropriate toileting ratio, if they have that appropriate toileting ratio, there is an excellent chance that they will continue to do well over time with the skeptic toileting or self-avoiding program. So it's our recommendation that people who achieve that appropriate toileting ratio during these 3 days. But that group should definitely be on top of the way they're scheduled for the program. What would a 56% ratio look like? Well, on your cards, if over the 3 days, if they had 4 voids in the toilet, and 2 voids on the clothes, that was caught wet twice, in other words, over those 3 days, if that were the case, then the appropriate toileting ratio would be 4 voids in the toilet, divided by the 4 voids in the toilet plus the 2 on the clothes. It'd be 4 divided by 4 plus 2, or 4 divided by 6, or 66%. So anytime that appropriate toileting ratio comes up to greater than 66%, any higher than that, they definitely should be included on a toileting program, according to our recommendations. Treasures to watch for is my next slide. And in terms of things to watch for, when you're serving, this is a type of service, it is a little dangerous not to have somebody on a twirling program, simply because surveyors tend to look at people being on check and change programs, on out on down bladder, is that being a chance or a possibility that the resident's highest level of functioning is not being maintained. Because maintaining continence is a possibility where a twirling program is considered a higher level of functioning than just being changed and checked routinely. Again, it's very difficult. I mean, I told you earlier that I think a lot of people either don't want it or they don't want it. A lot of people just not responsive and they stay wet. Even when you try to do the twirling assistance, and it's entirely appropriate to play by my check and change program. But if you do that, I would be very certain to have documentation in the chart that you document the resident's preference about this and have a discussion with them when you're placing them on check and change. And it's important to do that even if you put them on a twirling program. It's more important to do it if you elect not to put them on a twirling program, because there will be increased survey surveillance about that. If you put someone on a check and change program and you thought that this was the resident's preference, we had this discussion, we did this 3-day trial, and they were wet 80% of the time, your appropriate twirling ratio was very small, 10%, whatever, etc. If you document all of that, I put them on a check and change program, it's almost impossible to consider or conceive of how you would not be meeting those survey regulations and best practice guidelines in terms of how individualized and confidence you have. I certainly, if you had that documentation, you got a deficiency, I would feel very comfortable in defending you for whatever they said. Okay, so next slide, things to watch for too. If you do this 3-day trial, you will occasionally get a patient who appears highly motivated to be twirling, but continues to be very wet. So this classical case is that you're coming around every 2 hours, trying to sit there, you're here, you want to go to the bathroom, and she says, oh yes, please take me, but she's still wet. Or Mrs. Smith says, yes, please take me, I need to go. And you start sifting them to the toilet, and as soon as you start moving them around, lifting them, for instance, for transfer, there's leakage in the wet. That would be a common stress pattern. If you see a patient with such bad stress incontinence, it's one of the things that you're supposed to diagnose, actually. If you see a patient with bad stress and cause of your pattern, you'll get to them, they'll swim, they'll try to go, but they'll be wet very frequently, and when you move them, they'll have some leakage. That's a classic stress pattern. You can diagnose stress and cause, which is that alone. The other pattern would be a pattern where you go around to the patient every couple hours, but it's not enough. The patient basically is wet and said, I had to go, an hour ago, it's just 2 hours ago, so I can't wait. As soon as I feel something, as soon as I feel a little sensation, I've got to go, I only have a couple minutes. The other way to see that is you get there every 2 hours, and the patient says, yes, I'll try to go, I really have to go. And they don't leak when you lift them necessarily, but they just start going. Not just a little bit, but they start a pretty major void between the time that you're there and the time you get them to the toilet. So just bad enough and have a small enough bladder capacity, there's just nothing much you can do about that with the toileting probe. I mean, you could, I guess, try to get there every hour, but that's so labor intensive and really, to be quite frank, so invasive to the patient, I don't really think it's a realistic option. With either of those two patterns, either the patient has a stress pattern or if they have an urge pattern, I think the reality is they won't do well clothing trial. They certainly won't have a 66% appropriate clothing ratio. The clothes will be wet a lot of the times, and that's the kind of patient you should refer to follow-up if you have the option to do that, to a urologist or somebody else who specializes in incontinence care, because there are things you can do about stress and urge incontinence if a patient is highly motivated. I mean, those are the conditions, stress and urge. Those are the conditions where biofeedback might work. There are drugs that at least will work with urge incontinence. I heard there was a question about estrogen creams. Theoretically, I don't think there's great evidence about that, but that's another treatment that they use for people who have urge patterns. So there are other things that you can do if a patient really shifts to high motivated but continues to be wet. You can diagnose the type of incontinence, number one, and number two, you can refer them for follow-up. I wouldn't put them on a prompt avoiding program, though, unless the patient didn't really want it, because they're not going to benefit terribly much. So, the upshot is, if people have very high frequencies of wet, when you put them on that 3-day trial, but very small incontinent voids, in other words, leakage, but still wet, and pretty normal incontinent voids, that probably means that the most common type of incontinence, and unless you know stress or stress and urge mixed, and they should be given on follow-up. You can continue them on the prompt avoiding program if you'd like, but I would still offer referral because the results from prompt avoiding the scheduled coding program are simply going to be less than optimal because of their condition and because of their problems. Okay, at this point, I'll take questions on anything that I've said. The upshot of the summary of what we have said is that there are at least two excellent reasons to do a 3-day trial. One, because of the new regulatory guidelines that focus on that. And then number two, even for one, it's absolutely the right thing to do anyway. Because it's absolutely the right thing to do, because if you do it, if you do it following those guidelines that we just provided, then you can identify that group of people who are responsive to it and who want it. And you can identify the group of people who are not responsive to it and write the appropriate documentation and language that would defend your decision about their incontinence care. There's no other good or defensible way to do it. And this is the most defensible way, according to all the evidence, is to be the clinical trial, which is why it's now the focus of the MDM. So I believe in the next week or so, that's what we're going to be focused on.
Yeah.
So, Annie, should I take questions now?
Yeah, let's do questions. I want to clarify one thing for everybody. Today I emailed to everyone our prompt avoiding card, which we touched on in a few of these slides here. If you haven't opened it, you might want to check your email for that. But I also want to let you know that we are sending those cards to you in the mail. Those cards, a sample of those cards, went out in the mail on Monday. And so it should be hitting your nursing home, I don't know, today, tomorrow, or the next day. And there are enough cards in there with the instructions to assess, to do a prompt avoiding 3-day trial with 10 residents. That's what we're recommending for your next assignment. It's a recommendation. You can tailor it any way you like. You can choose not to use the forms that we're sending you. But we're highly recommending them that you at least give it a shot, at least try it with 10 residents, and let us know how that goes for you. We'd love your feedback, because again, we don't view this assessment form as a final form until we hear from you how it's working in the field. Are there any